Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That guy over there, well, that's the lovely and cuddly Mr. Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Howdy.
Listen, I get a chance to travel the world and see some remarkable places and get a chance to hear stories, which you know I love, history and stories.
Mm-hmm.
And after the kind of stoppage for the Holzer Files earlier this year, we had that 3-month layoff where everybody was trying to figure out what the new world was going to be like. And then when we went back to filming, we went out to Massachusetts to film an episode. And one night Shane and I had off and I was like, God, you know, we are like minutes away from Salem, Massachusetts. And it's kind of ridiculous that we're just stuck here. What if we see if there's a ghost tour group that, you know, we know none of them are open, but maybe they'll take us on a little walking tour and just kind of show us the insights. And we made a few calls and looked a few numbers up and connected with a great group and Black Cat Tours out of Salem, Massachusetts, and a lovely couple that runs it agreed to meet with us off hours, just friendly kind of, yeah, we'll show you around and talk to you, because, you know, the tours were shut down. Everything was kind of shut down at that point. But we all met separately. We all had a chance to, we were wearing masks, so we were being very cautious at that time. And we kept our social distance. But it was, you know, quite late at night. And it was an impromptu kind of tour just to talk to us about this. And they were great. As a matter of fact, they've also got a book called Black Cat Tales, History and Hauntings of Old Salem. And hearing some of these stories, Tim, I got to tell you, we've talked ad nauseum about the witch trials in Salem throughout the years, right? I mean, probably in the 15 years we've been on the air, it's safe to say we probably talked the Salem witch trials at least 10 of those years.
Sure, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
One way, shape, or another. And we always hear kind of, you know, the same take on it. And although Michel Bellanger brought us into a different aspect of it this year, after the Salem Live program, this couple brought me in a little deeper. Now, they were also part of the Salem Live program, and it was great to connect with Lara and Daniel and talk about the rich history. Today's episode, Salem's Secrets. Tim, we're going to go a little deeper. Obviously, we're going to touch on some of the witchcraft trial aspects, but there's more important aspects of it, I think, that people just aren't as familiar with. And our guides tonight will take us through this journey of history and hauntings together. So welcome to Darkness Radio, Daniel and Lara Fury. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
You guys were great. It's so personable. I loved the little impromptu tour. I thank you guys for doing that and for just allowing us a little glimpse into the remarkable history of that part of America. And I wanted to start off maybe going back a little further. And Lara, I know that you were talking to me about some of the different aspects I didn't even realize regarding what that area was like. What was Salem in that area like prior to the Salem witch trials? And you had some really interesting aspects to share with us. So why don't you take us back to the beginning and talk to us about that sleepy little town and what was it like? What were the people like? What was the lifestyle there?
Thank you. It's very common for people to blame the afflicted for what happened in Salem in 1692. You know, a lot of the portrayals of the girls as these you know, scheming, you know, teenagers who were, you know, either trying to find, you know, love connections or just become more popular even somehow through that. And it's such a falsehood, because we're placing modern sensibilities on children who were in a really terrifying situation and time period. Now, the forests of Massachusetts were referred to as the Howling Wilderness by some people. Salem Village was where the Paris Parsonage was, and that's where all the events start to take place. That's where many of the afflicted and accused lived in Salem Village. That's now the town of Danvers. The trials and executions themselves took place in Salem Town, where many of the other players of this event lived. And that's now modern Salem. That's the city of Salem. Now, from what we know, Salem had a spiked wall 9 feet high around it as a defense from the native population due to raids and skirmishes from King William's War, which is part of the French and Indian Wars. Several of the afflicted girls were orphans from those wars, their parents having been killed in native raids, including, we believe, the famous Abigail Williams, who everybody talks about when it comes to the trials, because she's one of the most high-profile afflicted. Now, one of the biggest things that people don't realize about this time period is that in February of 1692, a new English charter had been put into place, which removed a lot of the protections and forward thinking of the colonies that had been in place, starting with the Body of Liberties Act of 1641, which prevented things like cruel and unusual punishment. And I mean, things like they had protections in place for, you know, animals, and that they should be treated well. And this English charter kind of wipes all that out. And a lot of people are really upset about this. They say, we're just going to get rid of it. We're going to go back to the original charter. And so there's a lot of hostility involving that. One of the other things that's going on at this time is that there's a common belief that the divine reckoning would occur soon, probably in just a few years. I think Cotton Mather puts 1697 as one of the dates for that.
Okay.
So
is this like the rapture, or is this truly the end times that they're waiting for?
They're basically thinking it's going to be the end times. There's a lot of little things that have been happening that they start to see as a sign for the end of the world. And of course, the biggest thing when it comes to that end times is that there will be a war between heaven and hell, and the devil is going to walk amongst the humans, and we are going to have to fight him. And that's basically what the mindset of the Puritan religion was, is that the devil was a very real entity that could enter their lives at any time.
Now, this kind of lifestyle that they were leading, it sounds almost utopian in nature. The way that they were trying to be all inclusive and respectful. And I mean, is that a fair assessment?
That was their hopes. Absolutely. When they came here for, you know, freedom of religion and, you know, that's the basic idea of coming to the Americas in the first place. Yes, that's their concept, is that all men will be created equal. I mean, the Body of Liberties Act refers to, you know, treating your slaves as humans, not as property. Gosh, there's hundreds and hundreds of articles in the Body of Liberties Act, but they are all intended to be, as you say, utopian.
So this is kind of the life they're leading. And, you know, it's interesting because every generation believes they're the ones that are in the end times. Isn't that strange? I mean, there's still people, you know, you watch in a lot of the religions now, 2020, people are talking about, you know, all of these things lining up with biblical prophecy, this, that, or the other. But I've been hearing that since the 1970s, when I was old enough to start to pay attention to all of this cataclysmic nonsense of what was coming. But in a sense, there really was an end to the lives and the world that they were trying to build.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, as you say, we've gone through what, in 2001 the world was going to end, in 2012 the world was going to end. I think they were just talking about a rapture recently that was supposed to have happened. We're all, I guess it's human nature to be looking at, well, where's the end? You know, we all know we're going to die, but what's going to end all of it? There's got to be an end to it somehow. And so, as you say, these people living in, I mean, certainly for them, it wasn't, you know, all sunshine and roses. It was a very harsh life living here. And as I said, they've got, you know, attacks by the natives. Obviously, it's provoked on both sides, but there's a lot of war orphans. There's a lot of massacres up in, you know, what would become Maine. You know, 50 people were killed in one night in a village up there shortly before the witchcraft trials begin. So that's what they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. It's a terrifying time to be alive.
And now that this shift is taking over and the utopian hopes and dreams are starting to crumble, what is that turning Salem into?
That's where we start to see a lot of the, how do you put it? You know, fear of one's neighbor, where things that maybe previously would have been just passed aside as, oh, that's an unusual thing that happened. When the witchcraft hysteria begins, you start to see all those little events become more and more important. An old woman who mutters to herself under her breath, Sarah Good, you know, that suddenly becomes, well, was she casting a spell against me? You know, things along those lines. To talk about how all this begins, how the witchcraft trials begin, in mid-January of 1692, Reverend Paris and his wife find their daughter Betty and their niece Abigail crouched and twisted in odd positions under chairs and stools in the home, making strange movements and speaking in a language that no one can recognize. Abigail says that she has terrible pains in her head. Now, it's commonly believed that Betty started to show symptoms first, but it's difficult really to determine exactly when it spread from one girl to the other. The generally held theory is that because there were two other girls nearby who developed fits after receiving an ill omen during a fortune-telling session, that something similar may have occurred with the girls in the Paris household, but we can't be certain of that because the first time that we hear about it is when Reverend Paris starts to talk about what was going on with the girls.
So these girls are having fits. Now, you know, it's been kind of brushed away as though they were, you know, tossing about and acting strangely. But the way you're describing it, it sounds a lot more traumatic, like they were bending in ways that didn't seem natural, that they were acting in ways that were beyond just girls acting up and being ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, because we see, you know, everybody's seen a high school or college production of The Crucible, or, you know, they've seen the movie or something along those lines. And the way the girls always behave in that is they just sort of scream and writhe around. And, you know, there's some very, you know, talented, you know, young actresses out there, but there's a level to this that you never really see. And yeah, exactly. Their movements are bizarre. Now, the doctors at this time understand things like epilepsy and seizures. And so when it's believed to be Dr. William Griggs is brought in on February 24th, actually my birthday, to look at these girls, he proclaims that they are under an evil hand, which means witchcraft, because nothing that they're doing physically makes sense with anything he understands about medicine. And it's for what would happen later on, their early symptoms are very mild. Just those, the twisting and contorting. It's not as violent as it would become later on. It's interesting because as soon as Dr. Griggs gives this prognosis, Ann Putnam and Elizabeth Hubbard, who are two other girls, that they each lived about a mile away from the Paris parsonage in different directions. And the next day they start exhibiting symptoms as well. So it's a very quick transition once this diagnosis comes in of, you know, for lack of a better word, of witchcraft.
Now, a lot of these stories kind of entail that there are these vindictive little bitchy teenage girls. Yeah. And they start pointing fingers at people they don't like and making claims and acting up in order to play this big trick on people. And when they realize that they're getting the attention, they continue to do so. What you're setting is a bit of a different table here. You're giving us a different insight into what was happening. Now, people talk again about this being a form of mass hysteria that one, you know, started to spread amongst the girls. Again, it was a mental condition. Some have even talked about it, and now the word's evading my memory, but you and I laugh about it that night. Ergot, right? The right. Bad rye, and that it might have caused hallucinations and frothing at the mouth. Why don't you talk a little bit about those aspects of this?
Oh, sure. The ergot theory, to discuss that first. Everybody loves the ergot theory. They really do, because it's a way of taking away human culpability. So for those that don't know what the ergot theory is, in 1976, there was a study published by Linda Caporel, I think I'm pronouncing her name correctly, saying that conditions were right in Salem in 1692 for ergot to grow. And ergot is it's basically a mold that grows on rye. And it could have been prevalent in the area. So ergot has an LSD-like effect when you ingest it. And so for a lot of people, this seems like the aha moment. If there could have been ergot in the area, that explains why everybody was seeing things and hearing things and having these bizarre symptoms. So in 1976, this study comes out. Multiple studies come out within months of the original paper saying why it's not possible. So for one, it would have been extremely selective, you know, for only these certain people within the same household to be exhibiting the symptoms for having ingested it, you know, but not others. The second thing is all bread was served toasted. Puritans believed that untoasted bread caused stomach problems. So that probably would have killed off whatever ergot was left after, you know, baking the bread in the first place. The third thing is that ergot has a necrotizing effect. So if they had ingested it and the ergot was causing these hallucinations, the likelihood is that they would have developed basically like gangrene. They would have been losing ears and fingers. And at the height of the witchcraft hysteria, it seems pretty unlikely that no one would have noticed if everyone was suddenly afflicted with ergot poisoning and their, you know, fingers were starting to fall off. So if someone tells you that the reason for the witchcraft hysteria in Salem was because the girls were all high on LSD, you can tell them that's the bupkis, basically.
Right. Now, you also laid a fact on me that I had kind of remembered, but not exactly. Because a lot of people point to, well, listen, this isn't a real phenomena. These were just girls acting out. There's never been anything like this before or since. But there's actually been contemporary versions of the way these girls acted and reacted. Can you give us a little bit more information on that?
Oh, sure thing. So there's two really big instances of this occurring that were on, you know, in the national news anyway. The first one was in McMinnville, Tennessee, in November of 1998. There was a teacher at the Warren County High School who started complaining of a gasoline-like smell in the classroom. They experienced nausea, shortness of breath, dizziness, and headaches. And so they evacuated the school, and almost 100 students and staff went to the hospital with similar complaints, and about 40 of them were admitted overnight. So a week later, the school reopens, and the 71 people have to go to the hospital. So there's a massive investigation by multiple government agencies that takes place, and they find no cause, nothing at the school, nothing in the blood and urine samples from the afflicted. So they come to the conclusion that it was and this is the modern term, a psychogenic illness. And that's basically the modern way of saying mass hysteria. Now, the second one is even more of a parallel to what happened in Salem in 1692. So in August of 2011 in Leroy, New York, at the junior senior high school, 14 students, 13 girls, one boy, begin to have fits, convulsions, and a bizarre speech difficulty. And so the diagnosis is conversion disorder, mass psychogenic illness. Conversion disorder is a more, you know, fine-tuned way of saying that this is hopping from person to person, conversion disorder. And the parents aren't really happy with this diagnosis. They think, well, there's got to be something causing this. It can't just be, you know, it can't just be all in their heads, because there were YouTube videos, which I was having a hard time finding a lot of them. It seems like a lot of them have been taken down now, of these girls just having, you know, absolute fits and convulsions and their word slurring. And it's something that we talked about during when we took you on the tour, is that it's not pretty. This is not the kind of attention that a young, you know, middle school, high school girl would want. It's a really awful, traumatizing thing. So the parents, like I said, they're not happy with this diagnosis. So they put the girls, some of them, out on national TV. And it attracts the attention of Erin Brockovich, actually. She went to Leroy, New York, and to help investigate the possibility of pollution from a 1970 train derailment and possible toxic waste. And that turns out to be implausible, with, you know, the toxicity levels far too low. But there's now additional cases as well. And the only new observation from the specialist is that one girl exhibits symptoms of Tourette's. So what they conclude is that this one girl had a legitimate medical condition, and it spread to the others through conversion disorder, mass psychogenic illness. And that's what we used to call mass hysteria. So it's easy now to look at that, as you say, with a modern example of how easily, if, say, you know, Abigail Williams or Betty Paris had a legitimate medical condition. Abigail probably had some form of PTSD, and it then spread from person to person through this hysteria. It's very easy. I mean, humans are, you know, we're pack animals when it comes down to it. We create our little tribes, and we have to protect ourselves against, right, any form of, you know, outside thing.
Exactly. So obviously, you know, again, there is a statement that, okay, this isn't something that is a one-off. There is proof that this kind of example has happened. Now, and I don't mean to sound sexist or weird about this, but has it afflicted boys? Have we seen this being something that has also taken place in the male gender?
That's a very good point that you bring up, because there are definitely afflicted during 1692 that are men. Probably the most famous of that is John Indian, who was Tituba's husband. He was another slave, enslaved person by Samuel Paris.
Tituba being kind of the one that they thought was the instigator or spark, the one that was maybe opening these little girls up to witchcraft to begin with.
Right.
That was the original belief.
Yeah, she's very commonly seen as the you know, she's the first person that they accuse, because, well, she's really the only other person in their household that they, you know, could look to as an outside, you know, source of this. I mean, she later basically confesses that Stanley Parris beat her until she confessed. I can't remember the exact quote on that, but she says that she was given, you know, given beatings, and Samuel Parris admits to that as well. But that's just common that he just says, well, that's, of course I did that to get her to confess. That's what I would do. And it's horrifying, but that's the mentality at the time. But yeah, she's never accused of teaching the girls black magic or anything like that. That's, you know, that's a total manufacturing from the Crucible and Arthur Miller. That's not something that she's accused of. She's accused of torturing them like everybody else, you know, from that point on. But her husband becomes one of the afflicted. There's actually an instance where he convulses so violently, it actually takes four men, including the marshal, to restrain him. So, but as you said, it does seem to affect more women than men. And it's, as I was saying in when talking about the instance in Leroy, New York, there's at least one boy that we know of who's afflicted by this, but the, you know, the percentages are far off. And it's bizarre because you can go back to you know, ancient Greece and the meaning of, you know, hysteria comes from, you know, the female reproductive organs, basically. You know, that, you know, use the term hysterectomy. Hysteria is the same root word. So it does seem to affect women more than men, going back, you know, thousands of years, you know, to the original concept of hysteria.
Now, what I thought was a fascinating aspect of this story as well. All right, let's take it for what it is. Maybe it's a handful of girls acting out, jealous, petty, goofy little teenagers doing something stupid at the time without realizing how deep and profound the repercussions would be. That would be easy enough to buy into. Now, you shared an aspect of the story of one of these girls I had never heard before. And this was witnessed by multiple people. And do you know which part I'm referring to here?
About the fireplace? Probably talking about Mercy Lewis. Yes. So there's several things that during the trials that are...
I'm sorry, we're losing you. We're losing you real quickly. Your audio started to break up.
Sorry. So there are absolutely certain instances that happen during the course of the trials that are far more unexplainable than what we take from, again, the Crucible and the girls just screaming and writhing around, and that's the end of it. One of the first ones is, there's a similar thing that happens. Abigail Williams asks a man named Benjamin Hutchinson to attack the specter of Deliverance Hobbs. She's someone who's been accused of witchcraft. And she describes to him where he's wounded the spirit. And during the examination of the actual person, Deliverance Hobbs, she has a mark on her eye and on her side, which is exactly where Abigail told Benjamin that he had struck her. Jonathan Walcott has a similar experience where he says he attacked the specter of Bridget Bishop with his sword and his scabbard. And they find a matching tear in Bridget Bishop's coat. The other thing is, very often they, at the beginning, they would try bringing in the accused without an introduction to see if the afflicted would recognize them. And in many cases they do, even if they had never met them before in person. But the instance that you're talking about is Mercy Lewis's chair being dragged into the fire. And so she's sitting in front of the fireplace.
And Mercy is how old at this time?
Oh, gosh. Dan, you're going to have to help me on that one. How old is Mercy Lewis?
Mercy is about 16 or 17 years old at that point.
Okay. Dan has a much better...
She's sitting in a chair. And how many people are there as witness to what takes place next?
There's at least three people that are there because they're involved in what happens. the chair starts moving towards the fireplace, feet first. So Mercy is sitting in the chair, and the chair starts moving towards the fireplace. Now, I mean, obviously, you can think about somebody trying to, like, hop, you know, while they're sitting in a chair and do that. But what makes this so bizarre is, as it's moving towards the fireplace, two men each grab a side of the chair to try to stop it, and it still keeps pulling them. So this is a 16 or 17-year-old girl being pulled into the fire, and two grown men are being pulled along with it. And finally, Edward Putnam puts himself physically between her and the fire and is basically barely able to prevent her from just being thrown into it. Now,
so this is one of the girls who's afflicted and is kind of pointing the finger of blame, right? So this yes. isn't one of the girls who's believed to be a witch, but yet some supernatural force is even attacking her.
Yes, and that's what they're all saying is happening, is that these bizarre instances are going on around them. There's another one, Mary Black. She's a person enslaved by Nathaniel Putnam. She's during her examination, she's pinning her neckcloth, and this is during her examination, and several of the girls start, you know, screaming that she's hurting them. And so the court says, okay, do it again. Let's see if this happened, you know. And so she pins her neckcloth. Three of the girls scream in pain, and one of them, Mary Walcott, shows her arm and blood.
She shows her arm, and what happened?
And blood starts running down it.
That's creepy. And so they're describing it as though the pinning of this is actually almost like what we would picture voodoo dolls, right? The pin is affecting, through intention, these girls that are witness to this trial.
There's a lot of, you know, poking puppet dolls and things like that, which is, as you say, very similar to what we would consider a voodoo doll now.
All right. Now, those are weird aspects of the story I'd never heard before. Why do you think? I mean, that plays into the supernatural and the chilling even more so. Why are those aspects of the story that seem to be overlooked or ignored?
I think I blame the Crucible. When most people think about the witchcraft trials, it's they either read the Crucible when they were in school, saw a production because, you know, a friend, a neighbor, a loved one was in it, or they watched the movie because it's, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis and Winona Ryder, and they're, you know, very young and attractive and in love. And so that's an easy story for people to think of. So, or they, and a lot of people, honestly, we've had so many people take the tours over the years that think, oh, they were burned in Salem, and it was actually hanging in Salem because burning was considered cruel and unusual punishment. And it was, witchcraft was a crime against the colony, against the state. It was a federal crime. Well, federal's the wrong term, but it was not a religious crime. And so burning was for heresy, and witchcraft was a different sort of punishment in the colonies. So why don't all those interesting things come up? I think people they've never really done something that shows that. There's never been a form of easily digestible media that shows those aspects. So it's not in the public consciousness, as it were.
Those, to me, are more chilling aspects of this entire story. And I know there's even more we're going to touch on here as we continue speaking about it. But, you know, that's really kind of frightening that seems to supersede any of just the concepts that these were little girls acting up, being vindictive and acting strangely, because they were actually in danger as well, it would seem, and a part of something that was bigger than they were, something that was not just mean-spirited bad girls, but something much darker.
Yeah, I don't really know. I don't know why haven't come across as much as they should. You know, I mean, obviously we try, you know, on our tours and, you know, in our book to explain that to people, because it's so easy to just say, oh, it's girls being, you know, the bratty little girls that we know. They don't talk about the more terrifying aspects of it. And maybe it's because we just were scared of something like that. We're scared at something that we really can't explain away easily.
Well, we've got some more stories from the Salem witch aspect of it, and then we're going to delve more into other strange hauntings, tales of terror, and very strange goings-on in the town of Salem with Daniel and Lara Fury. But, Lara, what are a few of the other aspects, a few of the other stories associated with the witchcraft trials that you think are even more compelling than the stories that have been kind of vomited ad nauseum for 200 years, 300-400 years now?
Well, there's certainly instances, and Dan can actually help me with this one. During their investigations, during the examinations of a particular accused, where the now is it Mary Warren that tries to take Dan? Can you help me on this one?
There's definitely some really bizarre things that take place. Yes, during the examinations, during Elizabeth Proctor's examination, you have Abigail Williams trying to slap Elizabeth Proctor, and instead she just, it's described as if her hand almost starts to move in slow motion, and then she just falls to the ground and screaming and grabbing her hand. And saying it's burning, it's on fire, and the other girls start feeling the exact same thing. They're grabbing their hands. You've got a lot of odd things happening, especially in that room. It was such a circus almost atmosphere, because it's the perfect environment for that hysteria to just jump around, and it's not just going to the children. It starts moving to the adults in the audience as well, so it's jumping to them too. So people who before were not afflicted, suddenly they're just grown adults standing there and screaming, and they're going blind, and they faint, and so it's chaos really in this courtroom.
And you've got all of these people pointing fingers, all of these people getting involved. Do you think that there are adults that are taking what these children are dealing with, this affliction that's striking them, and using that to their benefit by pointing fingers and trying to, you know, air their dirty laundry and grievances in a way that seems less petty and more, look at the evil that these people are doing? Is there more of that underpinning to this entire story, do you think?
What seems likely is that the Puritan society was incredibly judgmental. The whole, it kind of hinges on the idea of predestination, the idea that God has already decided whether or not you're going to heaven or hell before you're ever born. And the Puritan congregation, you don't just get to join the Puritan church. You have to be voted in. You have to be put forward by one of the other members, and you have to be voted in. They have to all believe that you're not someone who's predestined to burn in hell for eternity. You're supposed to be one of the select few that joins this community, joins this church. And so it, by nature, by the design of it, the Puritans are always looking for something that's not quite right. They're always looking for the hints that maybe this person you know, maybe they're not holy. Maybe they are a witch. So it's almost like anyone is suspect. So they've probably got, I imagine, a running list. Whenever they encounter these people, they've got, you know, like John Proctor and Giles Corey constantly bickering with each other, constantly. Thought that there was, you know, Proctor was doing something to harm Corey. Corey thought Proctor was trying to harm him, and vice versa. So you would see things like that, these little petty things that we might think of today as though that's just, you know, that they're just being sniping at each other. But to them, the disrespect, the any sort of lying or the thought of being cheated or someone stealing from you, those start to really build up into thinking, well, if this person is being so, you know, I think they've been ripping me off. I think this person isn't keeping to the Sabbath. Maybe that person is a witch and we just don't know it yet. So that really is what happens in a lot of these courts. You see the explosion of that. Suddenly everyone has something that they've been holding on to for years. I saw Bridget Bishop and one day I looked away and then I looked back and I thought that she maybe turned into a boar. I saw a boar running past her house and then I looked back and Bridget Bishop was there again. And at the time I thought it was weird, but now that I know this has happened, now people are accusing her of witchcraft. That's really where you start to see it. I don't feel that we saw settling scores per se for people that didn't think that the people they were accusing were actually witches. As far as I can tell from the records, it seems like they did believe these people were witches because of those very same things. The things that made them not like them and made them upset, those become the evidence that this person is a servant of the devil.
Now, there are talks of curses during the witchcraft trials before and after. And could you touch on that a little bit for us? Because there was a story I know you guys shared with me that I, again, was unfamiliar with regarding, I believe, the judge in the case. And talk to us a little bit about those aspects, would you?
Sure. So the one that comes to mind right away would be Sarah Good, the homeless woman that Alara mentioned a little earlier. Sarah Good, the day that she's executed, which is July 19th, 1692, she's standing up on the gallows, under the ladder. There wasn't really a gallows, it was a tall tree with ropes hanging from it. And she's standing on the ladder, she's got the rope around her neck, and there's a minister by the name of Reverend Nicholas Noyes. He's the junior minister of Salem Town, but he is a real hellfire and brimstone man, minister. He's really pushing for what's happening here. And one of his duties is to try to get people to confess right before they're hanged. He'll call up to them and ask them to confess themselves to God, basically to clear their souls. But they're not going to be spared, but he's trying to get them to maybe God will have mercy on them. So on this day, with Sarah's up on the ladder, the rope around her neck, and the reverend shouts up, Sarah, confess yourself to God. He'll have mercy on your soul. And Sarah shouts down to the reverend, Reverend, I'm no more a witch than you are a wizard. And if you take away my life, God will give you blood to drink. Now, she's hanged. And the minister, years later, he ends up repenting for his role in the witchcraft trials. But witch in final words? Because it's believed that a person who was a witch, their final words were carrying a curse, and if they said it, it would definitely come true. And in the case of Reverend Noyes, on his deathbed, it was recorded that his mouth and throat filled up with blood in his final moments, choking him. Now, we see that likely what he suffered was a brain aneurysm, because apparently that does have the same, that's one of the symptoms that we see. But it's fascinating that it did really happen. So it's been called, the witch's curse, even though actually she was quoting the Bible. There's verse.
That was what was funny to me is they call it the witch's curse. But that what she threw out was actually reciting biblical scripture. And that's funny because you would think somebody that was of the devil and quoting scripture, especially in that moment, would have paid the price for that as well.
You would think it was, one of the examination tactics was to try and get a person to speak a prayer to see if they could say the prayer perfectly. And if they could, well, then maybe you're not a witch. But if you're a witch, if you've sold your soul to the devil, you can't really pray. Somehow it's going to stop up your mouth. You're going to trip over your words. And so they'd have them recite prayers in the courtroom as a way of seeing whether or not they could actually do it. And of course, even if you're a Puritan who knows your prayers backwards and forwards, if you're standing in this environment, you're probably going to slip up. As a matter of fact, the next month, the minister, Reverend George Burroughs, he's been convicted of witchcraft. He's in the same situation, standing on the ladder, the rope around his neck, and he speaks the Lord's Prayer perfectly and clearly so that everyone can hear. Hundreds of people can hear. He's a minister. He knows how to speak to the back of the room, and everyone hears him speak it perfectly, but they still hang him. So it's even in the case where you're able to utter a quote from the Bible, it's still not enough, even though they've told you before that it's going to be enough.
Now, wasn't there a famous ghost sighting to one of the, was it the attorneys or the judges after the trials ended as well? I can't remember. I believe, Laura, yes. You guys had so many remarkable stories, and I just want to hit on some of these other fascinating paranormal aspects.
Yeah, so I think what you're referring to is Sheriff George Corwin. So Sheriff George Corwin is he's the High Sheriff of Essex County at this time, and he's one of the least nice characters in all of this. He's the one in charge of the jail, and it's the sheriff that's responsible for the pressing of Giles Corey. Now, pressing is a torture that typically wouldn't have been allowed here in the colonies, but because of the new English law that's put in place in 1692, pressing is used because Giles Corey, 80 years old, he refused to allow the court to try him. This is probably the most famous of the stories of the witch trials, I believe. Giles Corey pressed with stones over the course of 48 hours, about 2 days. They're putting heavier and heavier stones until finally his rib cage breaks and the old man dies. And he refuses to allow them to try him. They're constantly asking him if he'll accept the authority of the court. And he just won't answer that question. His final words reportedly were "more weight." So asking for more weight to be put on the ship. So that's a very tough old man at the end. And not long after the trials, it's about 1696, Sheriff George Corwin, he starts to fall into ill health. He starts to he's losing weight, starts to have trouble getting around. And it's in April of 1696 that he starts saying that he's having trouble sleeping. He says that he's waking up in the middle of the night and he can't move. He feels like there's weight pressing down on his chest and on his arms and his legs. And when he looks to the foot of his bed, he believes he sees Giles Corey watching him while this is happening. And that same month, April 1696, just 4 years after the trials, Sheriff George Corwin, one morning, he's found dead in his bed. He had suffered a powerful heart attack in the middle of the night. And the sheriff is only 29 years old when this happens.
Jeez. Yeah, see, now those are some creepy coincidences, whatever you want to refer to them as. I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. That's some really bizarre tales. All right, we're going to do this. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We've touched on some of the famous witch trial stories and some of the other hauntings surrounding that. When we come back, more murder, mayhem, and mischief in the town of witches. When we return, you're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio.
Hi, this is Chris Myers. For more than three decades, I've covered some of the biggest events in sports and talked with some of the most fascinating personalities. But now I want to invite you to join me for my new podcast, CMI, The Chris Myers Interview on Podcast One. Covered a lot of events, World Series, Red Sox, White Sox breaking through at their time, the Super Bowl as recently as Mahomes and the Chiefs coming back against the 49ers. I was there to grab Brady after he had that tremendous comeback against the Falcons in the Super Bowl, and some tough times, the 89 earthquake World Series that rocked the Bay Bridge, and first to talk to O.J. Simpson live after both of his trials, and on the air through the 1996 Atlanta Olympic bombings, informing people as best we could at the time. We'll go in-depth on stories past, present, and future to the effect of the world of sports and everybody in and around it, from current athletes, Hall of Famers, and some people you and I know. Hope you tune in to CMI, The Chris Myers Interview, on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and Spotify.
Welcome Welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. Big changes brewing, folks. We're making the leap, and I'm hoping that you'll be joining us on this journey. We're going to be leaving Podcast One, making a move over to Midroll, which will be our new home for the program. We'll also be moving, their parent company is Stitcher. We're going to be moving our true crime program over to Stitcher Premium. Right now, you're spending $5 a month. You get the amazing True Crime Tuesday program every Tuesday and all of our archives. What if I said that same $5 will now get you True Crime Tuesday and all of the other premium Stitcher programming? And I believe, Tim, help me out if I'm wrong here, Darkness Radio Darkives are going to finally be released under that same premium blanket. So that one $5 charge is going to get you access to True Crime Tuesday, past, present, and future, and all of our past archives of Darkness Radio.
Yes, eventually everything, all the Darkives will be over there on Stitcher Premium. So you'll have all 14 years of the Darkives.
That we're able to recover. There are still some missing pieces. We're aware of that.
And there's a piece
you happen
two,
to have them. Yeah. You can send the links over to tim@darknessradio.com. We're still sifting through different piles of items to see if we can uncover some more of the old episodes that were lost from our old radio days. But you will finally have it all in one place to visit for $5 a month. And we're really excited about this. And it is a much better platform and format than we've been doing with Patreon, because Patreon has been unreliable and problematic for many of you that have followed us on True Crime Tuesday. We're very excited to be working hand in hand in Stitcher. They're excellent customer service and programs. So we're going to be able to bring that all over there. Our regular shows are going to be made available to you every week as normal. True Crime Tuesday and our Darkives will be part of Stitcher Premium. So it's going to be a really cool a change for everybody, and you get a lot more bang for your buck. But hold tight. Wait until we give you the official nod. You can keep checking in on our social media at darknessradio.com and on our YouTube page for updates on this for when we finally make the full transition over, which should be sometime in the next couple of weeks. All right. Today with us, we have Daniel and Lara Fury, Black Cat Tales, History and Hauntings of Old Salem. That's right. We're revealing Salem secrets today on the program. And maybe I was a little premature in saying we're going to leave the witchcraft trials and stories completely. We have one more creepy little tale to tell about the witchcraft trials, and then we're going to definitely move over to murder and mayhem as Daniel has a story to share. But Lara, what's the last little nugget that you wanted to share with us regarding the witchcraft trials and those people associated with it?
Well, it feels awful to say that this is one of my favorite stories, because it's, you know, everything involved, you know, in what they were dealing with is horrifying, and they were living through a truly traumatic time. No one got away clean from this. You know, they all, you know, carried the weight of it through the rest of their lives. But one of the stories that just fascinates me is during the examination of a woman named Alice Parker, Mary Warren, who was a servant of John Proctor, has a violent fit. Now, you know, we were talking about earlier that we worked on the Haunted Salem Live together, and a good friend of ours actually portrayed Mary Warren in the reenactment scenes of this. And I thought she did a fantastic job of really just showing how torturous the things that were afflicting these girls were. So she has this fit, and her tongue sticks out of her mouth until it literally becomes black, and everyone in the courtroom sees this and remarks on it. You know, this fit is so violent, her tongue is turning black. And Alice Parker turns to her and says that her tongue would be blacker before she died. And it just, that strikes me so much as, you know, these people who are being, you know, accused of witchcraft, none of them, not a one of them thought they really were a witch. I mean, if they did confess, it was because their words were twisted or they were coerced into that. But here we have someone who is literally on the stand and knows that her life is at stake. And she's so angry at what she's seeing Mary Warren do. She says her tongue would be blacker before she dies. And I just think that's really kind of badass in that moment. to be able to react in that way. But it also shows, like I said, how violent these fits were for the afflicted, that, you know, her tongue was physically turning black during it.
Jeez. Unbelievable. Great stories. I could see why that's a favorite of yours. What a bizarre but very detailed account of something that seems otherworldly.
And that's absolutely, it's in the court documents. If you go to the University of Virginia, I believe, they have almost all of the original court documents for the trials available for free for anybody to see. There's some fantastic books out there. Marilyn Roach put out some beautiful compendiums of all of those documents and day by day accounts of what happened during the trials, which saves you a lot of work as a researcher when somebody has already put everything through, you know, in a day by day account. You can look it up literally, like I said, you know, when they first get the diagnosis of witchcraft, it happened on my birthday. And it's kind of neat to look through and chart that with our, you know, with our own lives and see, okay, well, this was happening, you know, during April. Now you see they talk about cutting grass, you know, during some of these accounts. So, you know, life is still going on during all of this. Obviously it's a huge part of their lives for well over a year, but you know, the life has to go on.
The book, Black Cat Tales, History and Hauntings of Old Salem by Daniel and Laura Fury, is available for sale. We have a link on today's program, so you can find that book and order it for yourself. We also have a link directly to their website. So when you visit Salem, skip the rest, go to the best, go to Black Cat Tours and have a chance to meet with these remarkable people and their amazing staff. Get out and see the tours. They are, I believe, back to work now, right? You're doing compliance for the COVID-19 and distancing, but you're back to the tours.
Yep. The state of Massachusetts has a mandated limit on walking tours of 10 people. So you go out with your guide and it's 9 guests at a time. So it's a much more intimate experience than you've really ever been able to have coming to see the tours, especially in October. You know, we might be able to increase that amount a little bit depending on what, you know, the government comes back, you know, with for us. But no matter what, we will be running. And there's been a lot of stories about how Salem is closed. There's no, you know, Haunted Happenings was canceled, so nobody come to Salem in October. And it's absolutely not true. I think even New York Times ran an article about it. But Salem will be open. A lot of the big events won't be happening, but the shops will be open. The tours will be happening. There will be Halloween in Salem this year.
Excellent. And it is a rich place for amazing history. And I'm not just saying this because they were kind enough to take Shane and I out on this tour. I've been on a lot of ghost tours, many of them very theatrical and silly and kind of get away from the sense of what they're really there to tell us. And Daniel and Laura really have a love and passion for the actual history, for the untold tales and the stories that have perhaps been off track for centuries, and they bring you back into this world and paint a very rich tapestry of amazing history, hauntings, murder, and mayhem for you along this tour. So trust me, go see this tour, and then do me a favor, make sure you rate and review the tours on all of the different apps that are out there, because that really helps businesses like that to explode and get more detail. Why continue to just hear the same old rhetoric when you can learn more of the truths and pieces of information that are legitimately backed up by history? So make sure that you check out Black Cat Tours. And now, Dan, you know, I want to talk about the Clue murder, if you will, and we'll talk about why I refer to that in a few minutes. But there's a really fascinating murder mystery story that took place in Salem. And why don't you introduce us to the story, the year, and our case players?
Sure. So Salem, at one point, it was the richest city in the country. That's coming after the witchcraft trials, of course, after the Revolutionary War. A man named Elias Haskett Derby opens up trade between Salem and the Far East, to India and China, Sumatra, and many other nations, and Salem, the wealth just builds and builds. So if you've got a boat in Salem, you can make a profit at that point. So it's the idea of Salem sort of changes from this place where this dark and terrifying thing of the witchcraft trials happen to a place where you can make money. If you go there, you had 10,000 sailors a year coming looking for jobs on board ships. And there is a story that comes out of 1830 that became national news, actually the first national news in American history. It hit the front page of every newspaper, and that hadn't happened before that, which was the murder of Captain Joseph White. So there is a place in Salem on Essex Street called the Gardner Pingree House. It was designed by this very famous architect named Samuel McIntyre. And Captain White, when he lived there, is the early 1800s. Captain White lived there alone. He had some servants that waited on him hand and foot. His wife had died many years before. He didn't have any children. And the captain made quite a bit of money in the slave trade, which was illegal in Massachusetts during those times. But a lot of those shipping families, they still had a hand in it. They just didn't really talk about it. Captain White, though, he actually liked to brag about the money that he made this way. He said to a minister named Reverend William Bentley, I have no reticence selling any part of the human race for a profit. So a really nice guy when you think about it, facetiously. Captain White.
Obviously, right.
Yeah. The minister actually later said that Captain White had the highest signs of moral depravity to him. So he was just very well loved, as you can imagine. Now, Captain White changes his will in 1830. Previously, he's been using his will, sort of holding it over his relatives' heads, diminishing what they're going to get if he's unhappy with them. And suddenly, he makes a huge change to it, and he turns almost all of his assets, about 75% of his assets, to his nephew Stephen, which means that all the rest of the family suddenly has a huge drop in what they're going to get when he passes away. Now, by and large, the family's been trying to make the old man like them so that they can get a bigger piece of the pie when he passes away, but now it's all been taken away. One in particular is a man named Joe Knapp Jr. Now, Joe was related to the captain by marriage. He worked for the captain. He fell in love with the captain's niece, Mary, and the captain wasn't happy about this. So that's part of the reason why he cuts them out of his will. He fires Joe from his job, and he cuts Mary out of the will almost entirely. So Joe and his brother Frank get very, very drunk at a tavern in Ipswich, and they come up with a plot that if they were to steal the captain's will, and then he should die, then maybe they would get their hands on his fortune. Maybe the money would be spread out evenly amongst his heirs. So they steal the captain's will. They burn it in a barn. And in this tavern, Joe says pretty loudly, I wonder what it would cost me to be rid of an old man. And he gets an answer. The answer is from a man named Richard Crown and Shield. Crown and Shield has always been a troublesome member of the Salem Society. He was always a bully, always a thug. He was very, very wealthy family, but he'd frittered away every cent he had on gambling and on booze. And he was a pretty nasty kid, too. He actually burned down the schoolhouse at one point because he got in an argument with the teacher. So not a nice kid. And Crown and Shield agrees to accept $1,000 to murder Captain White. So with Joe helping him out, Joe actually sabotages the back window of the captain's home. That night, just April 6th of 1830, Richard Crown and Shield climbs into the back window. He goes up to the stairs, steps into the captain's bedroom. The captain's fast asleep. Richard takes a cane with a lead tip to it that he'd actually put together himself. And he strikes the captain over the head one time. So he crushes his skull, kills him instantly. But just to be sure he's dead, he actually stabs the captain 13 times in the chest. Every single dagger strike aimed at the captain's heart. And he doesn't steal anything. He kills the captain, and then he escapes the way he came in. He gives the murder weapons to Frank Knapp, the brother of Joe, who hides them under the steps of a church over on Howard Street. So when the servants wake up the next morning and they find Captain White murdered, suddenly everyone's talking about it. It becomes the biggest piece of news in the town, and then spreads throughout the country. And the main reason it spreads across the country is Stephen White, who is now basically the primary suspect, because the captain just changed his will. All the money's going to go to Stephen, and suddenly someone murders him. So Stephen decides that he's going to try and take the heat off of himself by publishing all the details to every newspaper in the country. He sends all the gruesome, gory details of this murder, and suddenly it's hitting the front page of every newspaper. My favorite is the Rhode Island American was an editorial newspaper, and the headline they ran with was "Salem Forever Stained with Blood, Blood, Blood." So even in the disclaimers, they're saying this is we feel it's our responsibility to publish this, even though it's graphic. So viewer beware, as you might say. They are still pushing out all the gruesome details. And that actually brings a special prosecutor along for the case, whose name is Daniel Webster. Might be a familiar name. He was a very famous attorney and ran for the presidency a couple of times. And he agrees to take on the position of a prosecutor. Now they just need to find the guilty party. And at this point, they've actually got several people in custody who they think may have been connected to the murder. And it turns out that someone actually overheard the tavern conversation between Knapp and Crown and Shield. And that gets them put in jail. Now, Joe said he hired Richard because he didn't have the pluck to kill the old man. Those are his words. And turns out he actually couldn't handle interrogation either. He ends up cracking. He writes a 9-page confession detailing everything that took place. The prosecutors have told him that if he confesses and he points the finger at Richard, saying Richard held the knife, then both him and his brother Frank, they're going to go to prison, but they're not going to be hanged. They're not going to be executed. So he makes this confession, and then Richard Crown and Shield, upon hearing this, one night hangs himself in his jail cell at the old Salem jail. And one of the things I think is fascinating about this is that Richard, he was very tall. So to make sure that he did in fact die when he hanged himself, he actually held onto his ankles the entire time that he was being strangled. And he leaves a note with poems. He was really an artist. He would often sing in his jail cell. He asked his guards to bring him books and games and musical instruments. And so by hanging himself here, Richard actually gets his brother George off of the crime. They were looking at George as another possible suspect because there was no way to link the two of them. He couldn't link George to the murder without Richard. George, who's being accused, actually he's found not guilty. They'd let him walk out the steps of the jail a free man. However, for the Knapp boys, even though they've been promised immunity, because Frank was on the property, Frank Knapp took the murder weapons from Richard Crown and Shield, they can actually rescind that immunity and they can consider them both the murderers. So both Joe and Frank Knapp end up being hanged for the murder. They are about 19 and 20 years old, respectively. So these are two very young men we're talking about. And now Captain White and the Knapp brothers are actually all buried in the same place. They're all buried in the Howard Street Cemetery, which was sort of a stranger's cemetery for many years. You did have people it's right in the back of the old Salem jail. So you have people that would die in the jail be buried there. And you also had sea captains buried there. People that didn't really have a place in town often would be buried there. So it's a very unique cemetery. It's actually basically the same place where Giles Corey was pressed to death. That's probably what it's best known as.
Jeez.
And
this murder takes place. The culprits are captured. This is, this horrific story. You said this really kind of captured the attention of the world, and it's one of the first times a story like this has spread nationwide on newspapers. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the first time in American history you've got the same this murder on the front page of every newspaper. And it got so much attention that people wanted to know more about it. They wanted to see more about it. So they had a stage show, basically, where they would take around these sets of mannequins to representing Richard Crown and Shield and Captain White. And they would be shown on stage as the brutal Crown and Shield murdering the captain in his bed. People are gasping in the audience as someone narrates what's going on. And this was taken all over the country. People just, they couldn't get enough of this. And it's really probably the main reason why they had to hang the Knapp brothers, because at this point the entire country wanted an end of the murder mystery and they wanted a bad guy to be hanged. So they almost have no choice but to find a way to hang somebody after it.
Now, the story just doesn't end there, right? This history remains prevalent to this location. The haunting of this mansion continues to this day, and in a dramatic fashion, if I understand.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why I like to mention both Crown and Shield's death and Captain White's death, because both of those seem to have left behind some kind of either spectral energy or some kind of haunting. The Gardner Pingree House, which today it's a house museum, so nobody goes in there except for tours that the Peabody Essex Museum will occasionally give. But one of the more commonly seen ghostly figures in our entire town is the old Captain White walking around within the house. And one of the things I've seen probably more than any other ghostly photo, because of course we always encourage our guests to take ghostly photographs during their tours. One of the things I've seen more than anything else is this very clear face of an old man looking out the second floor windows of the Gardner Pingree House. It's very unique and very interesting. There's also right beside the house, there's a property that was once owned by Captain White. Many people, actually, mostly children, actually, have said that they'll see an old man in a black suit and a white shirt, bald head, walking around out there. It's only children that have seen that, which I think is interesting. But people of all ages have seen this figure walking around in the Gardner Pingree.
Now, isn't it strange as well that that the Crown and Shield family, mm-hmm. their house had been somewhere else, and it actually got moved next to this mansion, which seems like a supernatural slap in the face that here these families are tied in fate, and now even the buildings that they lived in are synonymous with one another.
Yeah, the Crown and Shield Bentley house got moved right onto the property of old Captain White, which is, yeah, definitely a slap in the face. Although I don't think that Richard himself ever lived at home. I think they would have kicked him out if he did. But the family definitely had a presence there. And that house actually also appears in H.P. Lovecraft's story, The Thing on the Doorstep. Lovecraft says a lot of his stories in Salem, and in this one in particular, that thing on the doorstep, he talks about the old Crown and Shield place, and that's the house he's referring to.
That's fascinating. Now, I started it with a Clue-like mystery. Give us the cool little tie-in to Clue and this murder mystery and what is believed to possibly be the connection.
Well, sure. So the house there, it's this beautiful mansion. And right across the street is the Hawthorne Hotel. But years ago, back in the 1800s, that was the office for a man named George Parker. And George Parker was created board games. He joined up with his brothers to create the Parker Brothers, which we all know and love. They create their first factory on Bridge Street in Salem. So they are mass producing games like Monopoly and the Ouija board. And they're also importing games from all over the world. And it's actually in 1941 that the British murder mystery game Cluedo gets taken by Parker Brothers, and it gets they take part of it, they mass distribute it, and they change the name to Clue. And when you're looking at the Gardner Pingree house, it definitely has a very clear, almost a recollection, a very clear image of that body mansion in the game of Clue. For many years, been said that that's the, if not the inspiration for the mansion that they were creating. And right down to there's checkered floors in the kitchen. There's some very unique pieces of furniture that are in that house that you also see. I think it's the second edition of the game of Clue through the Parker Brothers. And of course, you have a character called Mrs. White in that game. There were stories told, rumors especially, of Captain White being murdered with a candlestick. It was pretty prevalent, and actually it wasn't true. He wasn't killed with a candlestick.
No, it was the lead pipe in the conservatory.
Exactly. And both, actually, the murder weapons are at the Peabody Essex Museum. They rarely ever put it out. I can't think of the last time that they put them out, but they have those murder weapons, the dagger and the cane. But those weapons, I think it was actually the Parker Brothers that probably started that rumor, try and connect the whole murder even just a little bit more to their game. Because, like I said, it was advertising itself. The murder was still fresh in people's consciousness. I mean, today, it's not something that's really talked about or thought about, but that was the biggest story of 1830 and for many years after that.
Wow. Very cool. And you've had people on your tours that have witnessed ghostly apparitions there.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I always take, you know, any ghost story with a bit of a grain of salt. I always look at it as critically as I possibly can. And this is one, it's so hard to try and take apart at all, because it's so clear. Clearly, this old man walking around, furniture sometimes being moved in the home. It's not often that anyone goes in there, so I'm not sure how it could be happening otherwise. There's another aspect to it, actually, which has to do with the old Salem jail, which is the same place where Crown and Shield and the Knapp brothers were locked up. There's a section of the first floor that's part of a restaurant. There's a restaurant there today. There's a couple different restaurants throughout the years. And I've spoken with a number of the waitstaff. And each of them tell me of this. There's a certain room, which today it's a place called Bit Bar. It's an arcade restaurant. They have a section that pinball games, but it used to be sort of cut off from guests. But a lot of folks that have worked there have told me about hearing whistling when they're back there, and sometimes a feeling like they've got this sort of cold hand touching their back. Several people from several of the different restaurants, independently of each other, have told me about this. And from what I can tell, where that's happening is the same place where Crown and Shield hanged himself, where he used to sit there and whistle and just be absolutely arrogant to his guards.
That's cool. Very, very cool. Well, we've got, I know we don't have a whole lot of time left together, but what are some of the other creepy, haunting stories that are associated with Salem that maybe a lot of people on the outside wouldn't know about? And again, folks, their tour is very in-depth and goes a lot more into detail into different stories. We're just hitting a couple of the highlights today and the highlights of some of their book. The book is great, very well written, fantastic stories that are easy to digest in quick little hits. So make sure that you get a copy of the book. The link is on today's episode, as is the link to their website and their tours. So make sure that you sign up, get in on this before they sell out all their tours for the upcoming season. But where shall we go next in the search for the macabre?
Sure. So there is one item that I think it's not likely you'll get to see when you're in Salem, so I'll mention it now. The Peabody Essex Museum, one of the artifacts that they carry is a skull, and the skull is believed to belong to Edward Teach, who was the infamous Blackbeard the Pirate, the captain of the Queen Anne's Revenge. Now, Salem's actually, it's had its fair share of pirates throughout the years. You imagine there was so much money leaving here. Silver packing ships are on the way out. And on the way back, you've got ships that are packed with cargo that pirates were always seeking. So up and down the Atlantic coast, you constantly were fighting with these pirates. So you had a lot of them coming into town as well. Blackbeard's the only one that seems like he may actually still be there. When he was killed off the coast of North Carolina, he was beheaded, and his head was taken all over the country, displayed as a warning to future pirates and declaring an end to the age of piracy. And in 1982, it was actually in the possession of a man named Edward Rowe Snow. And Snow, he's a historian, a pirate historian. His grandfather was a pirate hunter. He loved pirate stories, and he collected pirate artifacts. And one of them was he was able to obtain the skull. And in his will, the artifact is left to the Peabody Essex Museum. It's 1982 that happens, and there's a condition that goes along with it, which says that the museum cannot display the skull at night. During the daytime, it can be put out, but at night it has to be taken away so that no human eyes can see it. And the reason is that it's said that, and this is it, as part of the condition, that the skull comes to life, that its eyes glow bright red once the sun goes down. So no one is supposed to be able to look at it because there could be any number of terrible misfortune could befall someone who's able to see it. And now this, Edward Rowe Snow loved his tall tales. And his granddaughter was asked not too long ago about whether or not this was just another tall tale. And she said, absolutely not. She said that she had seen its eyes light up. She said she could sometimes hear it from the other room. And she said, we were just glad to be rid of the thing. The museum has the skull, but it's been a very long time since they put it out. I can only imagine that with the condition, you can't just keep taking an art of 300-year-old skull in and out of a box constantly every single day. So it hasn't been seen since 2007.
Now, with that said, have you spoken to any of the workers or late night staff where it's held? Has anything strange happened since it's been housed there?
Yeah, funnily enough, I try to talk to security guards really whenever I can, especially museum security guards, because you never know the strange things they've seen late at night. And there was one security guard that told me that when he's working on stormy nights, he'll look out to the old Salem burial ground. That's actually right across the street from where the museum is. And he says that he can see a man wearing a long gray coat with black buttons on the cuffs, black buttons lining the coat. He sees this man come walking out of the cemetery, crossing the street, and then entering the walls of the Peabody Essex Museum. Now, that's interesting because there are rumors and legends of Blackbeard actually holding secret meetings at the back of the old Salem burial ground, because he was someone who believed very firmly in using the supernatural to his advantage. He used to take cannon fuses and like put them in his hat and his beard and light them on fire. He wanted people to believe that he had this demonic power. So you imagine a cemetery is the perfect place for a pirate like that to hold secret meetings. Now, he didn't write his name anywhere, so we can't say for sure, but it is interesting that where this ghostly figure starts to come from is the same area where Teach himself once held meetings, and it would have actually faced out over the ocean. The South River used to run alongside of the old burial ground. So that's something that I've definitely been keeping an eye out for over the years. We've seen flashes of what could be a man, long gray coat, walking back there, but I haven't been able to get anything solid, anything specific. But that's one of those stories that I do love, the idea that there might very well be the headless ghost of Blackbeard looking for his skull at that museum.
Very cool. Lara, what about you? What's another fascinating tale from Salem's history that might not be known by the majority of the world? I know everybody focuses on the witch legend and lore of that area, but this place is so rich and steeped in history. There's so many aspects of the story of Salem. What's one of your favorites that's often overlooked?
Oh, gosh. Well, one of the sites that we go to is actually right next to the old burying point. And that's the Pikmin House. Pikmin is a very familiar name for, again, we bring up H.P. Lovecraft quite a lot. Pikmin's Model is one of his more famous stories, and that's talking about the same Salem family. Now, the Pikmin House is an original structure. It was actually hidden for a number of years. They had done so much work on the outside of it that it didn't look like the house that you'll see today, which is a first period architecture. And it's right across the street from another amazing site in Salem, which is the Yinyu Tung House, which is an 1800s Chinese house that was brought over to Salem piece by piece. And that has its own interesting thing, interesting stories about it. But what fascinates us about the Pikmin House is that, have you ever seen The Ring?
Oh, yeah.
So there's a story about the Pikmin House that we do not know if it is true or not. I'll gladly say this. This is one of those local legends that we cannot confirm. But there's a story that during the Scarlet Fever epidemic, there was a young girl who was basically quarantined in the attic of that house, and they would bring up the meals to her. And unfortunately, she would have passed away in that house because of the Scarlet Fever. And so when people go by the Pikmin House, they see this figure especially in the upper windows, that looks exactly like that character from Ringu or The Ring, the long dark hair in front of her face and a white nightgown. And we have had more sightings of that on our tour than anything else. That's the place that we bring people to when they say, I don't believe in ghosts. We say, all right, well, here's this. And we've had, people who just absolutely gobstop say, I never believed in ghosts until I looked into that house. And it is also a Peabody Essex Museum property. It's got some offices and storage in it, but for the most part, it's empty. So whatever it is that people are seeing up there, it's terrifying them. And it's not a living being.
And it's many people that are seeing this from many different walks of life without even a clue of what's supposed to happen there, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. People, we don't describe the ghost. If you take one of our tours, we're going to tell you the history first. That's the most important thing to us. And we want you to have a nice, backstory for whatever it is we're going to tell as the ghostly legend. And our ghost stories are almost all something that either we or someone we know or have spoken to has experienced. Unless it's a really, really prevalent local legend, we're not going to make up something on one of the tours. That's no fun. We want to tell you what people have told us when they turn around and go, you guys have a ghost tour? Well, let me tell you what I just experienced. And at this site, the Pikmin House, I consider it the most haunted house in Salem. There's other places that have that story because of, a famous ghost photo that was taken at the Ward House that has been disproved, multiple times. But with the Pikmin House, it's people, as you say, who haven't even heard that part of the story yet. They'll just be walking by and go, excuse me, I think I just saw something up there. And they'll all describe the exact same thing. This woman in a white nightgown with long dark hair. And my favorite story of anything that's ever happened on any of our tours is there was a young girl who took the tour with her family. And for Halloween, her parents asked her what did she want to be? Did she want to be something scary? She said, yes, I want to be the scariest thing I can think of, the ghost of the Pikmin House. And the family sent us a photo of her dressed as it for Halloween. And it's,
oh, that is very cool.
It, absolutely the highlight of us owning this company. We've run tours since 2013, and nothing has come close to that moment.
That is really neat. So many great stories. Why do you think people only focus on the witches and that aspect of this history, as opposed to all of the rich history and hauntings of that area?
Well, Salem did a real push starting in, I think, 2001, which is when I first moved to Salem. to push the maritime history. They had built this beautiful, beautiful ship, the Friendship of Salem. It's a replica 1700s vessel, and it's absolutely stunning. We finally have her back. She was gone for a couple of years, but you can see her down at Salem Harbor. So the city really tried to push this maritime history of Salem, which is obviously a much larger part of Salem's history. It was, you know, to the motto of Salem is to the furthest port of the rich East. And we have a fountain in the middle of Essex Street, which is the walking mall in Salem, that's meant to represent water as money running into Salem from the far East. So it's a huge part of what Salem is and its history, but something about the, as you say, the Salem witchcraft trials just captures the imagination. And I think it will continue to do so because it is unexplained. Even no matter how much we can have the conversation like we did earlier about how how hysteria is a real thing. But there's always going to be those stories like we were talking about that can't quite be explained. And I'm sure as you've experienced in all your years investigating, that's what intrigues people. It's something that doesn't have an explanation. And the Salem witchcraft trials just is the epitome of that.
It is a fascinating place, an interesting and notorious step in our history, and certainly worth examining. When you get to Salem, Massachusetts, and I recommend everybody visits just for the kitsch value and the interesting tales to be told, the museums to examine. But if you're going to go on a real tour, go check out Black Cat Tours and get the real story behind the stories. Get to the real history and hauntings and have as good a time as Shane and I on this. Daniel, Lara, thank you both. This was fascinating. We'd love to have you guys come back and visit with us again in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We will be back again next week, folks, with even more of the best in paranormal talk radio. Remember to keep your eyes peeled because things are changing. Big, exciting changes, a lot more bang for your buck and value for the best in paranormal talk radio. And we want you to continue your journey with us into the strange and unusual. As we approach our 15th anniversary, we want you to continue with us for the next 15 and beyond. You've been listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. This is Darkness Radio.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Life's messy. We're talking spills, stains, pets, and kids. But with Anababe, you never have to stress about messes again. At washablesofas.com, discover Anababe sofas, the only fully machine washable sofas inside and out, starting at just $699. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, That means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Upgrade your space today. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.